Welcome to the Prophet University audio series. Here are your hosts, Bill Kennard and Tom Grandy.
Welcome to the Prophet University audio series. I'm Bill Kennard, along with our company's founder, Tom Grandy. This program is entitled, Who's Minding the Store? Inventory and Other Internal Controls to Reduce Theft. Tom, this is the first presentation we've had on setting up internal controls to reduce theft and fraud. Do you really think that this is an important topic?
Absolutely, Bill. Michael begins his presentation with a quote from a publication called Report to the Nations. That report states that the average company loses 5%, that's right, 5% of its total revenue to fraud and or theft every year. That is a lot of money. He also covers several red flags to watch for within the office, including suggestions on how to monitor payables, receivables, and payroll.
You know, there were two things that caught my attention right away. The first was that less than half of all companies recover any of what was stolen. The second one was concerning vacations. Michael said to watch out for employees that refuse to take vacations. I think team members should take vacations just to maintain that work-life balance. But he raises an interesting point. This could be a red flag in the sense that they may not want others looking into their records or reviewing their areas of responsibility. Michael Bohens is the founder of an accounting, tax, and business advisory service firm called Keeping Score Incorporated, and is also the chief financial officer of Norheil Plumbing Incorporated, his family's plumbing company in Aurora, Ohio. Michael presents numerous business and financial management seminars to trades industry groups across North America and is a regular speaker and instructor for the PHCC, North American Educational Foundation, as well as an advisor for the ServiceNation Alliance. Michael also writes monthly columns for a number of trade journals. And now, with Who's Minding the Store, Inventory, and Other Internal Controls to Reduce Theft, here's Michael Bohens with this month's Prophet University audio series presentation.
According to the 2014 Report to the Nations from the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, 5% of the United States gross domestic product is lost annually to fraud. That amounts to $870 billion a year. The average loss due to a fraud in a company with less than 100 employees is $154,000. For a company with $1 million in sales, a $154,000 fraud loss can be devastating. That loss would amount to 15.4% of sales. It would have a significantly less impact on a company with $10 million in sales per year, which would amount to 1.54% of sales, as opposed to 15.4% for the $1 million in sales company. As we begin our program on inventory and other internal controls in business, let's first define the term fraud and the requirements for fraud to have occurred in the business. A fraud is any intentional act or omission designed to deceive others, resulting in the victim suffering a loss and or the perpetrator achieving a gain. In order for fraud to have occurred, three things are required: a need or motive, a rationalization, and an opportunity. These three components together are known as the fraud triangle. Instead of a triangle, I like to think of it as a three-legged stool. If any one of the three legs of the stool is missing, then by definition, a fraud has not occurred, i.e. you don't have a stool anymore. The first leg of the fraud stool is need or motive. A need or motive includes external influences such as health issues, drug, alcohol, or gambling issues, job dissatisfaction, non-shareable financial pressures, and influences outside of employment. Non-shareable financial pressures include things like medical bills, gambling debts, and living outside one's means. The second leg of the fraud stool is rationalization. Rationalization, or reasoning, by the perpetrator of the fraud includes thinking like the following: I'm just borrowing the money. I'll pay it back as soon as I get through this tough time. If I don't do this, I'll lose everything. I have no other option. There is no one else who can help me with this problem. This is owed to me. I deserve a raise, but my stupid boss didn't give me one, so I'm taking one myself. Everyone else steals, so why not me? I saw another employee take pipe and fittings from the inventory room right in front of a manager. The manager didn't say or do anything about it, so it must be okay for me to do too. The third and final leg of the fraud stool is opportunity. This is the only leg of the fraud stool that the owner of the company has any control over. The owner can't control the need or motive of a perpetrator of fraud, can't control the rationalization, but can control the opportunity to allow it to happen. Opportunity includes things like employees feeling like they'll be discovered stealing from the company or a client, they'll be caught committing a fraud. Safeguarding, protecting the company's assets. Instituting policies, procedures, and internal controls to reduce the chances that fraud will occur. These are preventative measures. These will help prevent fraud from occurring in the first place. Here are some summary points on fraud based on the 2014 report to the nations by the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners. Fraud is a significant threat to small businesses. The smallest companies suffered the largest median losses. They typically have fewer anti-fraud controls in place than larger companies, which makes them more vulnerable to fraud. In addition, because they have fewer resources, the losses experienced by small businesses tend to have a greater impact than they would in larger companies. This is the point I made at the beginning of the program. Small businesses should focus their anti-fraud efforts on the most cost-effective control mechanisms, such as hotlines, employee education, and setting a proper ethical tone within the organization. Victim companies that had implemented any of 16 common anti-fraud controls experienced considerably lower losses and time to detection than companies lacking these controls. Fraud is more likely to be detected by tip than by any other method. The majority of these tips reporting fraud come from employees within the victim's organization. Nearly half of victim companies do not recover any losses that they suffered due to the fraud. If you think about it, it makes sense. If someone has stolen money from your company and they gambled it all away, or they used it to purchase drugs or alcohol, that money is gone. It's important to note that all fraud starts small, but they get progressively larger the longer the fraud goes on. Here are the top five behavioral red flags of perpetrators of fraud to be on the lookout for. Number one, living beyond their means. This would be something like somebody buying a new Corvette every year when you know they really don't have the salary to afford that. That might be a red flag. Number two, financial difficulties. Three, an unusually close relationship with a vendor or corporate client. Four, control issues, unwillingness to share duties. Number five, a wheeler-dealer type attitude. Some of the other red flags to watch out for include divorce or family problems, irritability or defensiveness, addiction problems, and refusal to take vacations. Now, many of you may be out there thinking, wow, a person that refuses to take vacations is a great employee. Well, that may not totally be true. Why would somebody not want to take a vacation? If you're committing a fraud, you don't want to take a vacation because then somebody else will have access to your records or the position that you're doing, And frankly, this is how a majority of frauds are uncovered, is when people take a vacation, they're on vacation or medical leave. Finally, here are some warning signs of fraud. Shortages of cash, questionable purchases, missing, altered, or forged documents, falling company revenues, or rising company expenses. There is no way to completely prevent fraud from happening. However, there are things that can be done to minimize the risk. It's also important to note that the cost of preventing a fraud from happening in the first place is significantly lower than the cost of curing a fraud, i.e., recovering losses after the frauds occurred. So it's much cheaper to invest in preventing it from happening in the first place rather than attempting to recover after it has occurred. The most effective internal control that you can implement in your company is separation of duties. Separation of duties means that you are separating job responsibilities so no one individual has control over an entire transaction. The transaction would include things like accessing an asset, recording a transaction, and approving a transaction. For example, the person responsible for ordering inventory should not be the one to receive it and check it in. Nor should that person be allowed to enter the accounts payable invoice, authorize the invoice, or pay the invoice. A phrase that most contractors may have heard in the past is inventory shrinkage. Inventory shrinkage is the difference or discrepancy between the inventory listed in the accounting books and records of the company and the actual inventory out on the shelves in the shop. Let's take a look at some inventory internal controls that you can put in place in your company to reduce the chances of fraud occurring. The first inventory control is to lock it up. Lock up your inventory. Some companies have inventory cages. In this case, a cage is exactly what you might imagine it to be. It means the inventory is caged off. Other companies have separate rooms for inventory in their shop or their building. And this is where they keep the stock for jobs and their regular inventory as well. If this is the case in your company, locking up your inventory can be as easy as installing a lock on the door to the room and restricting access to that room. In addition to locking it up, many contractors install security cameras so you can see who's coming into and out of the shop or into and out of the inventory area. This is another great way to protect your inventory. It's been my experience that simply locking up your inventory and restricting access to the area, it's significantly improved the company's operations and reduced the company's overall material costs. That's because this is a common method of fraud that occurs in many businesses, including our industry. Employees enter the inventory area and take items for personal use or side jobs. And they do it because most companies don't have their inventory areas locked up, restrict access to it, or keep accurate accounts. Now, it's important to interject here. Not every employee is dishonest. 95% or higher of the employees that we have in our companies are honest people. So I want to make sure that you understand we're talking about the people that commit fraud. We're not saying that this is a carte blanche problem across our inventory, or excuse me, our industry and our businesses. A second inventory internal control is to organize your inventory. Not just your shop or your warehouse, but also your service and installation vehicles. The best example I can give in organizing inventory is a plumbing company that started in Southern California. The company's name and man behind the company is George Brazil. George Brazil was a renowned plumbing contractor who shared his inventory system with fellow contractors around the country starting in the late 1980s. Anyone that may have an affiliation with the plumbing, heating, cooling contractors may remember George, as well as those that are members or may have been members in the past of what is now known as NextStar Network and was known as Contractors 2000 at the time. There's an iconic photo that shows George Brazil in a truck with the inventory organized and laid out meticulously in front of the vehicle. Organizing your inventory in this way allows you to clearly see the items that you have and the quantity of each item that you have in stock, as well as on your trucks, on your vehicles. The next inventory internal control is authorization. This includes establishing a purchase order system whereby each order placed has a purchasing order number and/or a job name attached to it. This allows you to track the orders placed with your vendors, including what items were purchased, in what quantities, and at what cost. Another internal control for inventory is to count it. This includes both your warehouse and shop inventory, as well as on each of your vehicles. It includes comparing the purchase orders with the packing slips or receiving tickets that arrive when the items are delivered to make sure that the items and quantities match. If there's a discrepancy between the purchase order and the receiving ticket, then you know there's a problem. It may or may not be fraud, but it's something that should certainly be investigated. In addition to comparing the purchase order to the receiving ticket, it's also important to compare both the purchase order and the receiving ticket to the supplier's invoice when it arrives. You want to make sure that the items listed on each document match and are at the prices quoted. Again, any discrepancies most certainly should be investigated. Finally, you should also compare the purchase order and the supplier's invoice to your service invoices or your job tickets that your employees turn into the office. So your service tickets when you go out to Mr. or Mrs. Smith's house, the tickets that the employees turn in for actually doing the work, compare the supplier's invoice and the purchase order to those invoices to make sure they match as well, and that all the items on the service invoice are accounted for. A recent solution to inventory control issues has been introduced by many suppliers and vendors. It is known as a VMI, or Vendor Managed Inventory System. In a VMI system, you are essentially delegating inventory responsibilities to a vendor that you have a partnership with. In companies with larger inventories, you will often see even a vendor representative at the company's shop location, effectively operating as an on-site parts manager. Still, even with this VMI system, it's still your ultimate responsibility as a business owner to oversee this operation and make sure that it's operating properly. When it comes to authorization and approval, it's important to remember the following things. First, physical control over your assets is important. This includes securing your inventory, equipment, and also your vehicles. You should also tag and mark all company equipment and tools with identifying information, tags, and/or company markings. This will be helpful in recovering those items should they be stolen and pawned off for money by the thief. Without the proper identifying information, you are unlikely to recover them, even if you know that it's your sewer camera or CFC recovery machine sitting there at the pawn shop. I highly recommend that all company vehicles have GPS devices installed on them for safety and security reasons. The technology has advanced so far that you can now receive a text message, email, or phone call notifying you that one of your company vehicles is moving, either during off hours or if it's an area that is outside your service area, or possibly some place that the vehicle should not be, like a bar or a competitor's business. You can create geofences to notify you when your trucks enter certain areas. The cost of GPS tracking has dropped consistently and considerably in recent years. Combine that with the fact that many insurance companies will offer you a discount for having these devices on your vehicles, and the decision really becomes a no-brainer. It's not just the tangible assets that you must secure. Remember, you must also secure computer passwords and access codes to protect your intangible assets, your company lists of clientele and proprietary information. And it's important to have a list of employees who are authorized to access different areas and aspects of your business. Make sure you review the company records for proper authorization on a regular basis. Now that we've looked at some internal controls for inventory, I'll take a little bit of time and discuss some internal controls for other aspects of your business. Starting with payroll. Ideally, a time clock or other electronic reporting method for tracking employees' time is a good idea. At a minimum, or at least, have time sheets or time cards. It is required by law, by the way. Compare employee time cards with each other. If two people worked on the same crew at the same job, compare those two time cards. And also compare them against that GPS unit on the truck and or surveillance cameras that you may have on property, just to make sure that the hours recorded and time recorded is accurate. Have a supervisor review and sign off on a subordinate's time card. The employee entering the payroll data or information should not be able to approve time cards nor sign the payroll checks. Have a procedure for distributing the checks, even if it's direct deposit, acknowledging that the employee got the paycheck, even if it's a direct deposit receipt, electronic receipt, that it was recorded and received. And finally, it's important to restrict access to payroll records to only those individuals who are authorized to have access to them. Some accounts payable internal controls. Require a purchase order number or job name for all purchases. I mentioned that earlier in talking about inventory controls. Require two signatures on all payments, checks that are sent out. Now you can set a dollar limit at this, whatever is most comfortable and convenient for the company. In some of the larger companies, any checks over $5,000 must have two signatures to be valid. Smaller companies, you might not need two signatures, especially if the dollar limits are lower. Having said that, restrict who can sign the checks. Don't let 20 people have access to your bank account and authority to sign over the checks. 2, 3, maybe in larger companies, 4 people at the most should be plenty authorized to sign checks and issue payments. Compare vendor invoices with the purchase orders prior to payment approval. That's just to make sure that you got the proper pricing and you're not paying for either a different price or for items that you didn't purchase or receive. Set spending limits on company credit cards. Restrict the type of purchases allowed on account. A great example of this is company fuel cards. A lot of the fueling stations now, you can get a lot more than just gas there. You can have repair work done. You can get food. You can get alcohol. You can get beverages. So it's important to restrict the type of purchases allowed on account. The person entering the accounts payable should not also be able to authorize or sign the checks. If I'm able to enter a bill and also authorize its payment, that's not separating the duties, and I have the ability or opportunity to commit a fraud should I choose to go down that road. Also, blank company checks, company stock with computer process checks, whatever. All company checks should be locked in a secure area with restricted access. As I mentioned earlier, restrict the number of authorized check signers. The more people that you allow to sign, there's more chances for your internal control system to be circumvented. And finally, this is something personally I'm not in favor of, but some companies have a petty cash account. Even if it's a small amount, I'm not a fan or in favor of it. Some contractors have been victims of fraud through petty cash accounts, and it might not seem like a lot of money, but $50 to $100 every week or a couple weeks adds up pretty quickly. If you are going to have a petty cash account, though, please make sure that it's reconciled at least monthly, if not more frequently, by an independent employee or manager, or even outside bookkeeper or CPA could do it as well. Here are some accounts receivable and internal controls that you can consider in your company. If possible, two people should open the mail. Why should two people open the mail? Again, so you have a second set of eyes seeing what's coming in as far as check payments, invoices, bank statements, things like that. And I understand in smaller companies, two people opening the mail is not realistic. Some of the much smaller companies might consider just having a post office box where only the owner of the company has access to the P.O. box. And so the owner gets the mail, briefly sorts through it, and then passes it on to the individuals responsible for the various documents that come in the mail. You certainly should log and document all monies received, cash, check, or credit card payments. Stamp checks with restricted endorsements immediately when the envelope is opened. So if you get a client payment in for $500, as I open that envelope, I see it's a client payment, I immediately take my bank stamp that says for deposit only to ABC PHC Company checking account, and then the bank number under it, and I immediately endorse it to restrict how it can be processed. The deposit totals should be verified by a separate employee. In addition to this, I would say anytime cash comes into the office, even if it's a small amount, that a second person, possibly a third person, depending on the amount of cash that comes in, but at least one other person counts it to make sure that it's accurate. And then you have both individuals sign off on a sheet that, yes, this is the total cash that was received today. This is what we counted. That way somebody can't slip a $20 bill or $50 bill in their pocket and say, oh, this is the only, you know, this is the only amount of cash that came in. And they stuck $20 or $100 in their pocket. Keep your cash and checks locked in a secure area until deposited in the bank. Absolutely, just like your blank check stock. You really shouldn't keep cash and receipts on hand for very long. Ideally, you would deposit every day. I know for smaller companies where the cash flow is a little bit slower, it doesn't turn over quite as rapidly. It might be a couple times a week you go to the bank. But the point I'm making here is, you know, the longer you keep that cash and checks in your office and not in the bank, the more chance that there is something could happen, whether it's a fraudulent activity or not. The person that records the payments shouldn't be the same one that makes the deposit slip out. Now, why would we be worried about this? Well, again, if I'm the person recording the receipts that we got in the mail today, and I'm also making out the deposit, again, I could slip some cash into my pocket. I could modify a check that was received. Could say ABC PHC Company, and I could change who it's made out to or add my name at the end and then sign it and take the cash. On a regular basis, at least daily, and some of this now is automated by, depending on the credit card processing company you use, but batch out and reconcile your credit card payments every day. Invoices, company invoices should be pre-numbered, those that use paper invoices, and accounted for. I know a lot of companies are going to paperless systems with mobile units and electronic documentation. But if you have paper invoices that you still use, keep, just like you keep the blank check stock secure, keep your invoices secure. There have been fraudulent activities that have happened that way. Just a quick story in this area. A contractor did not keep track of his pre-printed invoices, and what he ended up having, what the plumber, the thief did, was wrote out the invoice as a service call only fee, brought that and turned that into the office, but because he didn't track his pre-printed invoices, the thief actually used another company invoice for the actual work with the homeowner, and then had the homeowner make the check payment out to the individual employee. And this fraud was not uncovered until one time a client called in with a warranty issue on work, and the contractor had no record of that work being done, and that it uncovered the fraud. The employee that had done that had since been gone between the time the fraud was executed and the time that it was discovered. And finally, any credits, refunds, adjustments to any accounts should require managerial approval. Again, this is another way that frauds can be committed. So if I have to make a refund to a client or a credit on an account or an adjustment, it should have manager or owner approval and sign off. So there you have just a handful of internal controls you can use in the various aspects and areas of your company. If you recall earlier, I said the number one internal control you could put in place in your company is separation of duties. Before you get to the actual internal controls, though, you should communicate the company philosophy when it comes to ethics and fraudulent activities. The owners and managers of the company set the tone, and so you should share that with your entire staff. At a staff meeting with all company employees present, let them know that you don't tolerate stealing of any kind in your company. Even if it's adding an extra receipt on a business trip for a meal that you didn't have, padding an expense report, adding 15 minutes to a time card if you manually keep track of time. 15 minutes a day, that's stealing. Even if it seems like it's a really small amount, it's still stealing and is still unethical. And it's important that you share the consequences of stealing or committing fraud with your staff so that they'll know exactly what's going to happen and what you will do if they are caught stealing. If you do catch someone stealing, you must follow company policy and what's in the company handbook. If it includes termination, then you terminate the individual if that's what your handbook says. And it doesn't matter if it's your best technician or your newest apprentice. You must apply the policy consistently. If you terminate an apprentice who you caught stealing, then 3 months later you find out and see that your best technician is also stealing, you must be consistent with your company policy and handbook and terminate that technician, even if he or she is the one that brings in the most money to the company. If you ever find yourself in that position, and you treat the second person, the best technician who brings in the most money, if you treat that individual differently, I can promise you that all your employees will know about it, and you may easily blow up or destroy your company's culture, your company's ethical culture at that point, because they see you're playing favorites. So yes, it might hurt in the short term, but a thief is a thief, whether it's an apprentice or your best technician. Just a quick story in this area on communicating to your employees that you won't tolerate stealing your company. A couple years ago, I did a two-part webinar series on fraud for the PHCC Educational Foundation. And during the first section, I talked about fraud and how it's important to communicate to your employees that you don't tolerate stealing in your company, similar to what I'm doing right now. And I said how if you just do that, if you just stand in front of your all your staff at one morning at a company meeting and say, look, I just want to remind everybody that we're an honest and ethical company and we don't tolerate stealing of any kind here. If you're caught stealing, you will be terminated. If you do nothing more than that, you'll be farther ahead than those companies that do nothing at all. So what happened in this scenario, one of the webinar attendees in the second session commented that he did exactly as I recommended after the first session. During his company meeting the day after the first webinar session, he stood up in front of his entire staff and told them that he would not tolerate stealing of any kind from the company, and if anyone was found stealing, they would be dealt with appropriately. I believe the webinar was done on a Wednesday, and so his meeting was held the next morning, Thursday. Friday morning, the company bookkeeper did not show up for work. Think about that for a second. Thursday morning, company meeting, tells everybody, this is how we operate here, we don't tolerate stealing. The next morning, the bookkeeper does not show up for work. As of the following Wednesday, the company owner was still unable to contact the bookkeeper. And by this point, he realized he had a problem on his hands, and he contacted his outside accounting firm to help him figure out exactly what happened. Unfortunately, I never got the contractor's name, nor did we ever find out what the end result of the situation was. I only hope that he wasn't taken for a lot of money, but I definitely know he had a problem on his hands, and he knew it as well. Once you put internal controls in place, it's important to monitor them regularly and test them to make sure that they're operating properly. You should also regularly review financial reports for the company, balance sheet, income statement, statement of cash flows. If you notice any strange amounts or percentages that appear off, maybe way off, compared to last month's results or last year's results or the budget that you have for the year, or maybe you have access to some industry benchmarks through a best practices group, you should investigate further. For example, if your material costs typically are 15% of sales, and all of a sudden you see that they're running at 18 or 19% of sales, you should look at those numbers more closely. It doesn't necessarily mean that you've got fraud occurring. It just means that you may have a problem. Maybe a large job went over budget on materials or something. Or in certain cases, it could indicate that fraud's occurring. Another great example that I like to use when it comes to looking at percentages is fuel costs. You know, if your fuel costs consistently run, say, 2.5% of sales, and all of a sudden they're running 3.5% of sales, but there hasn't been a spike in gas prices, something's going on there. So that's one area that you can look at. People might be filling up their personal vehicles, things like that. It's important to note that investigating fraud can be a legal minefield, so I'd like to share with you a few do's and don'ts if you're ever a victim of fraud. First, the dues. Due: immediately contact your attorney and CPA for guidance. Due: immediately secure your assets, change your passwords and locks, gate locks, access to buildings, notify banks, etc. if necessary. Due: keep the matter confidential. Don't tip off the suspect. Due: gather and secure evidence, documentation of the fraud. Due: contact the police and file a report. If the police will not send a unit out to your business or shop, then you go to them and file a police report. Certainly, if there's any kind of insurance claim involved, the insurance company is going to expect that that be done. Finally, leading into it, do consider contacting your insurance agent if you feel that you might be filing a claim. Here are some important things to not do. Do not do the following. Do not immediately confront or restrain the suspect. It's important that you remain calm. Do not immediately terminate the suspect. Do not identify the suspect to other employees. If employee A is caught stealing, you discovered a fraud, you don't go to employee B and C and say, hey, I caught A stealing. Do not write on or mark on original evidential documents. You don't want to take any evidence for the police and for the fraud examiners that may be called in to investigate. You do not interview the suspect during working hours in the office. And finally, do not interview the suspect alone. Do it with at least one witness, if not two, especially in male-female situations. If it's a male person that committed the fraud and the female is a manager, have another male there. If female is a perpetrator of the fraud and the male is a manager, have another male individual there. But always have one witness at least. And finally, just a final maybe do recommendation, reiterate one of the first ones, is it's important to contact your attorney. Like I said, this is a legal minefield, and so it's important to get the proper legal guidance and help you through this process. One false step and you could blow the case up. It could blow up in front of you and cause you problems when you were actually the victim. To summarize, I want you to remember that 5% of revenue is lost to fraud annually. The average fraud loss for companies with less than 100 employees is $154,000. With the current industry average net profit margin at approximately 5%, your entire profit could conceivably be lost to fraudulent activities. Following the guidelines discussed in this program and implementing the internal control procedures shared will reduce the chances that you'll become a victim of fraud in your business.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's presentation. Please feel free to give us a call at 877-202-8891. The vision of Grandy & Associates is quite simple. We teach companies how to run profitable businesses. For more information on how we do that, check out our website at www.grandyassociates.com or give us a call at 1-877-202-8891. Profit University Audio Series is produced and distributed by Grandy & Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line at 1-877-202-8891. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.